Good afternoon. I'm Paul Nicol, Managing Partner and Senior Financial Planner at GFM Wealth Advisory. We are a privately owned financial planning practice specialising in self-managed super funds and private portfolios. Our company holds an AFSL licence number 229401. This is the 19th year we've produced this investment market outlook recording. The purpose of the recording is to discuss with a financial expert some of the themes that are driving investment markets and where the potential opportunities lie in the coming 12 months. We are doing this recording on Wednesday, the 16th of August, 2017. It's not long after financial year 2017 has finished, which turned out to be a very good year for investors, with the average super fund returning just above 10%, a terrific result compared with the very low rates of interest at present. The Australian share market returned 14.09% for the financial year, and international shares in Australian dollar terms returned 14.74%. A-REITs had a more difficult year, falling 6.26%, but over the last 5 years have been a standout performer, returning 18.07% per annum. The RBA cash rate in Australia is currently 1.5%, and at present there is much speculation in the direction rates will move going forward. The Australian dollar traded in quite a narrow range against the US dollar last financial year, but recently we've seen it moved up above 80 cents. And bulk commodity prices recovered strongly throughout last financial year. Markets spent much of last financial year focused on macroeconomic themes. Markets have had to contend with the Brexit vote, a messy election result here in Australia, Donald Trump being elected president of the US, various elections across Europe feared to see populists gain power, the US Federal Reserve resuming interest rate hikes, North Korea stepping up its missile tests, and continued concerns about the sustainability of China's GDP growth and the large levels of leverage in the Chinese system. As most of you would know, we specialise in the management of private investment portfolios and self-managed super funds, and we run a very active and intensive investment management model. Our team, including the accounting team, numbers 28, all located at 190 Through Road in Camberwell. Now a disclaimer. This audio presentation is not an offer or invitation to any person to buy or sell any interest in or to deposit funds in any type of investment. Information here is of a generic nature. It doesn't take into account your investment objectives or your financial needs. No person should act on this information without first seeking competent professional advice specifically relating to their particular situation. What we're trying to achieve from this recording is to look into the future, perhaps the next 3 to 5 years, to give some ideas as to where money should be invested and where perhaps the better opportunities lie. So for our interview today, our special guest is Stephen Helmarick. Stephen is the Chief Economist at Colonial First State Global Asset Management, having been appointed to the position in March 2009. Stephen has over 30 years' experience as a financial markets economist. As the Chief Economist at Colonial First State Global Asset Management, Stephen works closely with all the investment management teams to ensure a broad understanding of the macro environment impacting on markets. Stephen is also the key spokesperson to clients and media on all macroeconomic themes and the broader financial market issues. Stephen holds a degree in economics from Macquarie University and a graduate diploma from the Securities Institute of Australia. He is currently the chairman of the Australian Business Economists and has been a member of the ABE Executive Committee for over a decade. In late 2015, Stephen completed the Australian Institute of Company Directors course, and in May 2016 was elected to the board of the CBA Staff Super Fund. So Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's get underway by first discussing the global economy. So the IMF in April revised up their 2017 global growth outlook to 3.5%. That number increased from 3.4. This was the first upward revision for many years. So why the upwards revision in that global growth number? And is that a positive sign for the global economy?
Well, thanks, Paul. Yes, I certainly think that's a very positive sign for the global economy. We're seeing now people, including the IMF, revise up their forecasts, as you said. And this is the first upward revision we've experienced for many years. The really good thing about the momentum in the global economy is that it's quite broadly based. So it's not just the US post the Trump election, but Europe is doing a lot better. Japan even is doing better. And growth in China has been sustained at higher levels than generally expected. So we have a broadly based improvement in the global economy. And that's been enough to see the rate of unemployment, the unemployment rate, come down just about everywhere, also in the context of very modest inflation. So 2017 looks like being a good year for the global economy, and 2018 even better, expecting growth next year of at least 3.6%. So after being mired in the low 3% growth rates for many years, things are looking better both this year and next year for the global economy.
Terrific, Stephen. Let's focus on the US. Now, the US Fed has started to raise its official cash rate over the last 12 months from 0.5% now to 1.25%. Are more increases likely? And if so, could these rate increases potentially slow growth in the US?
So we've had 4 rate hikes from the US Fed so far, one end of 2015, one end of 2016, and 2 in the first half of 2017. For the remainder of this year, we're expecting one more rate hike, probably in December, so very late this year. We're expecting 2 more rate hikes in 2018 and again 2 more in 2019. So that will take the Fed funds rate to a peak of around 2.25%. There is a chance that then by 2020, the US Fed could be lowering interest rates. But over the next few years, we expect the continuation of this very gradual rate rises. The other thing that I think is going to be really important for markets is that the Federal Reserve, very shortly, we think in September, is going to start the process of unwinding its quantitative easing program, or reducing the size of the Fed's balance sheet. Prior to the GFC, the Fed's balance sheet was about $1 trillion. It's now $4.5 trillion, so $3.5 trillion of quantitative easing. The US Fed is maintaining that program currently by reinvesting all the maturities and coupon payments they receive from all those bonds they own. From September, we think they'll start fading out that reinvestment, so they won't be reinvesting the whole amount that they receive every month. And by September 2018, the Fed has said that they'll probably have a cap on that reinvestment of $50 billion a month. So from September this year onwards, a very gradual beginning of unwinding that quantitative easing program. So that will happen together with continued gradual interest rate rises. We don't think that's enough to slow the pace of growth in the US economy, but likely to keep it around that 2-2.5% mark.
The current economic growth cycle in the US economy is now 96 months long. Are there any obvious imbalances in the US economy which could threaten the current growth cycle?
Well, certainly the Federal Reserve, as we just mentioned, wants to keep that growth cycle going. So normally, as economists like to say, economies don't die of old age. Now, something has to happen to create an imbalance that then causes a recession. So that's why the Fed's going very, very gradual on the interest rate increases and will be very gradual on the balance sheet unwind. But of course, we're now dealing with a US economy that has Donald Trump as the president. So when he was elected, there was big expectations of a large fiscal stimulus package, big company tax cuts, big income tax cuts, lots of infrastructure spending, lots of deregulation. And the expectation was if that could all be implemented, you would see significant increase in economic growth in the US, maybe up to 3-3.5%, maybe even 4%. Now, the expectations on that fiscal stimulus package are fading fast, disappearing over the horizon because the president has obviously found it very difficult to get much done at all, particularly on healthcare. So we'll be watching very closely to see what type of fiscal stimulus the president can get through. And if he can get some tax cuts through, that should support growth. If not, growth's likely to remain pretty modest.
While still on the US, in the next couple of months, there's some big events, big political events that are due to fall. We've got the budget, we've got the lifting of the debt ceiling, and the new Fed chair replacing Janet Yellen. What's your take on the political events of the next few months, Stephen?
Well, certainly those three events I think are going to be really important for financial markets. So Congress is currently in summer break, but when they get back late in August, they'll have roughly 12 sitting days to try and pass a budget. The new financial year in the US will start on 1st of October. So the Congress needs to pass a budget for the coming financial year. If they don't do that, they have to then use a mechanism called the continuing resolution, which will give the government the authority to keep spending money. If they don't pass that, then you end up with the situation that we had in 2013 where the government actually shut down for a few weeks. At the same time, the US debt ceiling will need to be raised. US debt at the moment is approximately $19 trillion, and they need to raise that debt ceiling. Again, in 2013, that caused a lot of concerns from markets, and that's when the US had their AAA credit rating downgraded by S&P. Now, you would think with the Republicans in majority in both the House and the Senate, and of course in the White House, they would come to a deal. But so far, the evidence, particularly from the healthcare failure to repeal and replace the Obamacare, indicates that it's pretty difficult to get this Congress to do much. So markets are going to be a bit worried about that budget and debt ceiling issue. And as you mentioned, Janet Yellen's term as Fed chair comes to an end in February 2018. So the president will have to nominate a new Fed chair over the next few months, and that person will then have to be ratified by the Senate. There is some chance that Janet Yellen might be reappointed, but that looks doubtful. Usually new presidents like to put their own person in the office. And so the best speculation at the moment is that a gentleman by the name of Gary Cohn might become the new Fed chair. He's currently actually the head of the National Economic Advisory Council in the White House. So if you like, Donald Trump's chief economist. So it looks like he could be appointed by the president to be the next Fed chair. And he has a long career in financial markets. So I think markets will take that relatively well. Certainly probably better to have somebody that the markets know than a surprise candidate that Donald Trump might pull from somewhere else.
Moving to Europe, 2017 seemed to be full of political risk for the region, but recently we have seen some encouraging signs of economic growth in Europe. Are we past the worst of the Eurozone risks?
Certainly Europe is looking a lot better. I think that's been one of the surprise factors this year is the strength of the European economy. It's growing at well over 1%, 1.5% to 1.75% per annum. That's pretty good for Europe. And it's relatively broadly based. It's not just the northern countries, although Germany continues to do very well, but pick up in France, pick up in Spain, and a few other places as well. But as you also mentioned, at the start of this year, there was a lot of concern about the political risks in Europe. We had elections in Netherlands and, of course, the French election and German elections coming up. And so far, the results have been quite encouraging, particularly in France. The election of Emmanuel Macron in France was a very positive development for financial markets. He's a pretty plain vanilla centre-left politician. He has a good, strong majority in the parliament, and he was elected by a large margin. Of course, the concern was that Marine Le Pen from the National Front was going to win, and she wanted to hold a referendum for France to leave the euro, and which we think probably would have been the end of the euro. But that has not happened, and so France is looking a lot better under President Macron. And Angela Merkel looks like she will be re-elected as Chancellor of Germany come late September. That will be her fourth election term in a row. She'll be the longest-serving leader of any major leader in the world. And so a Macron-Merkel Europe looks a lot better than we thought or we feared at the start of the year.
And Stephen, Brexit, have markets been able to grasp potential outcome of the Brexit situation?
Well, Brexit, I think, is going to be messy. The two-year negotiation period, which is now underway, is going to be very messy, particularly given the result of the election in the UK, with Theresa May now only governing as a minority government. So I think the market is probably underestimating how difficult the negotiation process will be. I think my view is that the European authorities have no incentive to give the UK a good deal because they don't want anybody else to go down that path. So I think it's going to be a difficult time for the UK as they negotiate the terms and conditions of that exit, which has to be sorted out by early 2019.
And now, Stephen, moving to China, China's annual GDP growth number has been remarkably stable over the last few years, pretty much defying market expectations of a potential slowdown. But there is plenty of scepticism of the veracity of China's official GDP data. What's your take on where China's positioned at the moment?
Well, I think one of the words you use there is the key, which is stability. The president of China has made it very clear that this is the year for stability. And the reason for that is that there's the big People's Congress, National Congress towards the end of the year. It should be in October. And that happens every 5 years. It's about putting in place the people who will be in power for that five-year period. There's a seven-person Politburo committee that runs China. The president and the premier are on that committee with five other people. Those five other people will change this year. So five will rotate off and five new ones will come on, but with the president still firmly in control. So he has said that he wants economic and social stability leading up to that Congress, and he's achieving that objective. The official data for the first half of this year was GDP growth of 6.9% per annum. Now, I think you're very right to point out that we should take those official GDP numbers with a grain of salt. They have been referred to being man-made. They come out very, very quickly after the end of each quarter. But if we look at the broad sweep of Chinese economic data, and including not just official numbers, but if you like, private sector numbers, the economy does look like it's held up quite well in the first half of this year. And we are expecting a slowdown in the second half of the year and probably more of a slowdown in 2018 as financial conditions are tightened to try and maintain stability in not just the economy broadly, but things like the property market. But over the medium term, we're expecting growth in China of around 6.5%, maybe a little bit lower on the longer term timeframe. So anything around 6 to 6.5% growth in China is pretty good news, you know, pretty good pace of growth. Certainly there is a lot of debt in China. There's lots of things to worry about in terms of the build up of debt. But I think we need to ensure that we don't just look at China through, if you like, Western eyes. We need to realize it's a different system. It's a different way of government. And so far, the government has shown they're very capable of maintaining that good, solid economic momentum.
Focusing now on the Australian economy, Stephen, Australia's GDP growth number finished at the end of March 2017 at 1.7%. In fact, the lowest rate since the 2009 GFC-inspired slowdown. So I guess the first question is, why is Australia's GDP number a little bit softer than it has been for a while? And is that a sign of more difficult times ahead?
Well, it's interesting with Australia. I think on one hand, we've got lots to celebrate because we've just passed 26 years with no recession in Australia. That's a remarkable achievement. You know, by some measures, we've just beaten the Netherlands to hold the world record for the longest period of economic growth of any OECD country. So that's really worth celebrating. But as you just said, you know, the annual rate of growth now, 1.7%, is the lowest since 2009. It's well below our long-term trend, which is closer to 2.75%. One of the big reasons for that slowdown in growth is that business investment is very soft. So we've seen mining investment come down a long way from its peak in 2012, but the non-mining sector is not really picking up its investment. So both mining and non-mining investment, very, very soft. And I think we can all feel that the economy, you know, could be and should be doing better. And one of the key issues here is really a lack of significant economic reform for a number of years, both sides of politics. So it's the debate at the moment seems to be more about dividing up the pie rather than growing the pie. So I think what we need to see is further productivity enhancing economic reform to try and keep this, you know, 26 years of great growth going.
Couldn't agree more. Now, the RBA cash rate's currently 1.5%. It's been 1.5% now for the last 12 months, and there are some suggesting that the RBA cash rate's bottom and that rates may start to go up from early next year, but now there's also a school of thoughts that rates may fall further. What's your view on where the RBA cash rate is at present?
So, as you said, we've been on hold at 1.5% for a year. Our view is that we are likely to be on hold at 1.5% for probably at least another year. So our forecast is that the next move in interest rates is up, but not until very late 2018. To be precise, our forecast is for an increase in November 2018, Melbourne Cup Day, always a good day for a rate move.
Yeah.
And the reason for this is the Reserve Bank has made it very clear, and Dr. Phil Lowe, the governor of the RBA, has been very clear that he's balancing a number of risks. The first risk is that the consumer income growth is very soft. The annual wages growth rate is 1.9% as at 30th of June. That's pretty close to the inflation rate. So after inflation, there's no real increase in wages. And of course, that weak income growth number is seeing more spending on things like people's mortgages and their energy bills. So there's not much extra money in the consumer's pocket. On the other side, we've got a pretty hot housing market, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. And so the Reserve Bank doesn't want to throw more fuel on that fire. And we've got inflation as at June at 1.8%, so just below the Reserve Bank's target range of 2 to 3. So you've got weak income growth on one hand, a hot housing market on the other, and inflation pretty close to target. And so the Reserve Bank is saying, balancing all those risks, the best thing to do is leave monetary policy exactly where it is.
While talking about residential housing here in Australia, I think the general view is that housing is expensive and that household debt to income, you know, recently hit new highs of around 180%. So it does appear there's too much leverage in the Australian residential property market. Is this a risk for our economy and, in fact, also for our banking sector?
Well, certainly debate about the housing market goes on. And when we look at those household debt numbers, household debt to income, 180% is very high. It's very high by our own standard and it's very high by global standards. But when we disaggregate that number or pull it apart, things are not quite as bad as that headline number would lead you to believe. So that's gross debt to income 180%. When we take off the fact that most people have an offset account or, you know, equity redraw facility on their mortgage, if you net that out, net household debt is around about 100% of income. So it's quite a bit lower. And importantly, it's been flat for about the last decade, which really means that as interest rates have come down, most people in Australia have used those lower interest rates to pay off their mortgage faster rather than increase consumption. The other thing is, too, that the debt in the household sector in Australia is owned by the people who can afford that debt. So the top 40% of income earners in Australia own the vast bulk of the debt. So it's not a subprime problem. It's not a, you know, low-income people being saddled with too much debt. And as you said, most of that debt is in places like Sydney and Melbourne. So when you pick it apart, it's not quite as bad as the headline number. But that's not to say that, you know, houses are not expensive. They are expensive. We have a significant amount of household debt. So the stock of debt is very high, but the flow, the ability to manage that debt is still pretty good because interest rates are low. The debt is owned by people with higher income and the unemployment rate's been coming down. So I think there's not a systemic problem in the housing market, but I'm pretty sure there's pockets of problems. So there's probably oversupply of apartments in some areas, particularly Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne. There's people who perhaps may have taken out interest-only loans who've got into the property market only recently. I think there's some pockets of concern there. So I would describe it as not a systemic risk to the economy or the banking system. There's certainly pockets of risk that need to be monitored pretty closely. And fortunately, both the Reserve Bank and APRA are on the job, and the banks are changing their interest rates and changing their behaviour to reflect the reality of what's happening in the housing market.
While we're focusing on debt, the Australian government, as of 30 June 16, had total debt of around $420 billion, and that number is continuing to grow. So how important is it that the Australian government gets this debt under control? You know, for instance, if we can't get the debt under control, is Australia's AAA credit rating at risk?
So Standard & Poor's still have our credit rating on negative outlook. It's been there for over a year on negative watch. The other two major rating agencies, Moody's and Fitch, have us at AAA stable. My view is that Australia's government debt is not too high. I've said in the past that we should have more government debt, because the real issue is, what do you do with the money? So if we're borrowing money to fund recurrent expenditure, that's a bad thing. If we're borrowing money to build productivity-enhancing infrastructure, I think that's a very good thing, because the infrastructure will return more to the economy than the cost of the debt, because global interest rates are still, you know, very low. So I think it's a bit too simplistic to say we've got too much debt and that's a problem. I want to always look at what is the debt used for. And we saw a little bit of that narrative in the budget earlier this year. I think we need to see some more. So it's going to be really important for the government, both at federal and state levels, to make sure that they can cover their recurrent expenditure with recurrent revenues. But I think use debt to build capital, to build assets, particularly infrastructure, to really help drive growth in the economy.
And focusing on the Australian dollar, Stephen, after reaching a low of 72 cents in last financial year, the Australian dollar against the US has strengthened quite significantly recently, in fact, trading slightly above 80 cents. So why has the AUD against the USD strength, and what's your outlook for the Australian dollar?
So certainly the Aussie dollar has been much stronger, I think, than just about anybody expected. We are seeing the interest rate differential, so the relative Australian interest rates to US narrow. And in fact, if our forecasts are correct, early in 2018, the Aussie-US interest rate spread will go negative, which means US interest rates will be higher than Australian. That's very, very unusual. Last time that happened was the late 1990s or early 2000s, when the Aussie dollar traded under 50 cents. Mm. So you have to ask yourself what's different this time, and the answer is it's the current account deficit. So the current account deficit is the difference between the savings pool in Australia and the investment that we undertake. And if there's a gap, then that gap has to be funded by global capital coming into Australia. Normally, that current account deficit is about 4 to 5% of GDP in size. At the moment, it's 1% of GDP. Mm. So it's a very narrow current account deficit. And that means that just quite simply, less foreign capital has to come into Australia to keep the economy moving along. And because of that very low current account deficit, we don't need interest rates higher than the rest of the world. So that's why the dollar has been holding up despite interest rate spreads coming down. The other factor is, well, global economy is doing better, and the Aussie dollar is quite often seen as a barometer of global economic growth. Commodity prices have picked up, particularly things like iron ore. And as all that's been happening, the US dollar has been weakening substantially. So after Donald Trump was elected late last year, the US dollar had a big rally and expectations of some big, you know, big policy changes, you know, that America would be made great again, quote unquote. And now as expectations of those big policy changes fade or disappear, the US dollar has been weakening. So the euro is stronger against the US dollar, the yen stronger, the Canadian dollar is stronger, the New Zealand dollar is stronger, as are we. So it's a combination of Australian factors, global factors and US factors, which are seeing the Aussie dollar so well supported.
The Australian share market, somewhat against expectation last financial year, returned 14.09%. And Australian superannuation investors enjoyed very strong returns for the financial year. So I guess the question, Stephen, is what are the major reasons why Australian investors did enjoy such a strong year of returns? And are these type of returns sustainable going forward?
So I think there's a number of factors there. One is that the global equity markets did well. Global share markets were up quite strongly. And that's really reflective of the improvement in the global economy that we've talked about. Here in Australia, we saw good improvement, particularly in the mining sector, as commodity prices came back on. So that helped enormously. But the really critical thing for the Australian economy is that we're seeing that the profit share of the Australian economy is surging higher, while the wages share falls dramatically. So that has been reflected in the share market. So the corporate profits are taking a larger slice of the economic pie, whilst wages take a much smaller slice. And of course, that's really great for equity investors, not so good for wage earners, but good for the equity market. And that's been particularly in things like the mining sector and the banking sector and a few other parts of the local market as well. And when you think about the fact that we've, as we talked about, had 26 years of growth, inflation pretty low, wages growth is low, the Reserve Bank's keeping monetary policy steady, you know, all those factors add up to an environment that's pretty benign for businesses. And so the equity market's been able to do well, both in a better global context and a local environment where the profit share of the economy has been picking up quite significantly. So the question then is, can that be maintained, as you said? You would expect that given how much of an increase there has been in the profit share versus the wages share, that can't be sustained, that some of the improvement in income will have to flow from profits to wages. And for the broader economy, we really will want to see that. So I think that probably suggests that it's going to be difficult for the local equity market to repeat the performance of 2016-17 with that 14% plus return. But as we've talked about, inflation's likely to remain low, interest rates are likely to remain very low, so that should help.
Stephen, we're getting to the tail end of the recording. Perhaps I could ask you to crystal ball a little bit. If the news generally out there is somewhat positive at the moment, but if I could ask you to focus on a possible black swan event for share markets for the global economy, what do you feel this could be?
Well, there's a few things going on in the world at the moment that are not that positive. As we mentioned, the Brexit negotiations have to happen, and that could be difficult. We've got the German election later this year. It looks like Angela Merkel will be elected, but if she's not, that could be significant. I think the political changes in China will be really important. There's some discussion of the Chinese president trying to push for a third term, which would mean he'd be in power for 15 years. So you have, Russia run by a person being in power for many, many years, and maybe China as well. But I think the two areas where we're going to have to focus most attention are what does President Trump do and what happens in North Korea, and maybe those two things combined. So the way I view the North Korean issue is that, the leaders of North Korea have been a little bit crazy for a long time, but we've managed to keep a lid on it through, diplomacy and negotiation. But now we have a president in the White House in the US, which, his method of dealing with these things is very different to others in the past. So it's kind of ramped up the rhetoric. So I think there's some, definitely some dangers there. But I'm hoping that the Chinese will be able to moderate that situation and keep North Korea under control, because the last thing China wants is for a collapse of the North Korean regime. And in the US, I think it's just going to be a continued new way of a president behaving. So we're going to have to read all the tweets and all those type of things. But the real issue for me in the US is what actually gets done. Can we see the policy stimulus package that the president has promised actually be implemented? Or is it going to be another 3.5 years of, lots of words, but not much happening? So I think we're going to have to watch that very, very closely.
Thanks, Stephen. So the last question, it's the first time in many years we've seen a synchronised upswing in global growth. So notwithstanding the geopolitical environment, does this make you somewhat optimistic about the return outlook? Let's talk medium to longer term.
Yeah, it does. I think, here we are almost 10 years on from the start of the global financial crisis. And I think after many years of kind of just grinding away, we are seeing better signs for the global economy. I think that's pretty clear. So global economic growth is going to be stronger over the next few years than we've had in the last few. The monetary policy pendulum is swinging higher, so we're not now worried about who's going to cut interest rates further into negative or who's going to do more quantitative easing. We're now thinking about interest rates moving up a bit, quantitative easing coming to an end. I think that's a very positive sign. So stronger global economy, less central bank intervention into markets, I think is a positive thing. So over the next 3 to 5 years, if that can keep going, if the geopolitical risks can be contained, I think we've got a good chance of the global economy seeing a much better growth over the next 3 to 5 years than we've had in the previous 3 to 5, and some more normalisation of global monetary policy. And I think that should flow on then to business confidence and business investment. And we get a pickup in business investment, and you get more jobs created and more income for the households. That's the virtuous circle, more global trade. So I think we've got a good shot of that happening if we see the right outcomes on the geopolitical risks.
Terrific, Stephen. Well, I think today you've been absolutely fabulous. The feedback that you've been able to give us and the insight into global markets is very much appreciated. You performed our CD in 2016 and again in 2017. We really appreciate your time. Thanks, Stephen.
My pleasure. Thank you.